Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. They said of the famous choreographer George Balanchine that he did his best work inside the very architecture of the music. Well, Mark Morris works the same way. When he brings his solo piece, Serenade, to a Boston stage this evening, the audience will see a singular piece of work. Well, that comes from two artists, the composer, Lou Harrison, and Morris, choreographer and dancer. It is a standard of performance that Morris has used as a foundation of his own dance group, one that he has built on for the past 24 years, establishing its international reputation for skill and innovation. Well, this hour, a chance to talk with Mark Morris about his work. Why is it, for example, that music is so essential to dance? It almost goes without saying when you say the words Mark Morris, yet the question is worth asking. Why is it so integral to imagining the movement of the human body on stage with music? How does the structure of a composition, the symmetries and rhythms, inspire the movement and form of dancers on stage? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and I'm joined in the studio by Mark Morris, whose company is performing tonight here in Boston. Mark, good of you to be with us here.
Thanks.
Tell me about the Serenade piece that you're dancing. This is a solo of yours, right?
It's a solo dance, and there are also two musicians, a guitarist and a percussionist. And it's a piece that was written by Lou Harrison in probably the 70s. And it's a piece that I loved. I've done probably five or six or seven dances to his music. He was a good friend of mine. So this is like a lot of his music in several different styles. He was a great sort of internationalist with music and knows a great deal about everything.
He died last year, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
He died at the end of February last year, so just about a year ago.
And yeah. Is this piece then in a tribute to the man, the friend, the man, the artist, both? What? How do you see it?
Oh, yeah, all of that. The man, the friend, the man, the queer, the man, the sign language expert, the man, the Esperantist. He was a fabulous, darling friend. Everybody I've met has either heard his music and loves it or has never heard of him. Those are sort of the two options with Lou. And so I'm a little bit prejudiced, but I was starting this dance because I needed a new solo. I make up a new solo every once in a while. And I was starting to work on this dance to this wonderful piece of music. And I decided I wanted to play castanets in the last movement because the last movement is sort of based on Scarlatti's Spanish-style music.
You wanted castanets playing or you...
I wanted me to play the
you
castanets.
You wanted to play.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the percussion part includes finger cymbals, which I also play, but that part is written.
Just part of like a Spanish dance class when you were 3 years old?
Or? Oh, I was a fabulous Spanish dancer. That's what I did first. When I first started studying, it was Spanish dance. I did that for 10 years probably, exclusively. So anyway, I hadn't played castanets for about 30 years and thought it might be a good idea. So I was, of course, as you always are with dead people, I was about to call him on the phone to ask if he would mind if I played the castanets, and I knew he would sort of say, okay, what you feel you need
to. He'd fuss
to.
A little bit. But
yeah,
then
it's like,
yes.
Yeah, go ahead, you will anyway. But then he died instead. So I felt slightly responsible and started the dance really the next day and dedicated it with deep love and appreciation for Lou.
Can we hear that last movement? It's the fifth movement of the of what does he call it? Serenado? Is that the name?
It's called Serenade. There's another piece called Serenado, which is of course Esperanto for serenade.
Okay, and there's Serenade by guitar, and I'm just sort of making marks and scribbles all
That's
over
fine.
My pages trying to keep
yeah,
track.
Yeah, Serenade
of them.
For guitar and percussion.
But this would be the part that we're going to listen to now. Are we going to hear your castanets and finger cymbals? No, this is because you're doing them on stage.
Yeah, I play the castanets live, and this is a good recording, but it's not of our show.
All right, Lou Harrison. Thank you. All right, Mark Morris. Now, for those people who weren't watching their radios at the time, what were you doing with your hands all through that?
Me? I mean, here in the studio?
Yes, here in the studio.
Well, I was blowing my nose and, like, practicing invisible castanets and I don't know what else. Fluttering. I think it's called general hand jive.
How many times have you danced to that piece, though?
How many times? Mm. Oh, my God.
Yes.
Well, I've been performing it for about a year, so that's a lot. That's probably 40 times, and then rehearsing it several times a day. I don't know.
And you still
hundreds. So,
but you still hear it,
hundreds.
And you still are drawn to move to it, right?
Oh, yeah. It's my job.
Yeah, I know. You don't sit there with your legs crossed and your hands folded neatly in front of you.
No, I don't do that much anyway. I mean, I don't sit that way. But, you know, it's a beautiful piece of music. If I couldn't bear listening to it hundreds of times, I couldn't be bothered to make up a dance to it, frankly.
Does a piece of music have to meet that test for you to say, look, I think I can do something with this as a choreographer?
Yeah, well, you know, sad to say, that's sort of the number one thing. Like, does it drive me crazy in a bad way? And that's impossible. It has to be something, even if it's not the greatest work of music in the repertory, it has to have some hook to it, some sort of something that can tickle me over and over again. You know, and ideally, a piece of music is good enough where it bears, you know, delving into, digging into, and really finding out how it's put together and why it works so beautifully every time. Otherwise, you know, it's boring. There's plenty of boring music. You don't have to search far for that.
Now, when you choreograph a piece, I've read that you do it, you say, I've got it right, and then you never touch it again. It's kind of finished, and you're kind of finished with it. You want to move on. Is that fair?
Well, pretty much, you know, because we sometimes bring back, in my company, we bring back repertory from the olden days, sometimes pieces that the current members of my company have never performed because
right.
they weren't born yet. Believe me, they weren't born yet. But I don't change those pieces. New people learn them from video and from memory and the oral tradition, but I try not to change them because I believe, end up with just one big, long dance. You know?
That you were forever revising?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't, you know, so I may disagree with some of my choices that I made 20 years ago in choreographing a piece, but, you know, too bad, that's what I did then. If something's a horrible, glaring mistake, then I fix it, but I don't really revise things.
So I'm sitting there trying to puzzle through how your brain works, which may be actually a dangerous place to go
on
public radio.
Well, let me know if you figure it out.
Yeah. You, as a dancer, can take this immense pleasure in doing something over and over again, dancing to the serenade, to the Harrison piece. But as a choreographer, you're more like an oil painter, where once you've got the canvas filled in the way you want to sort of move it along and start with something else. It's in a way, two different ways of approaching the same art, dance, isn't it?
Well, it's two different jobs, really. So as a performer and as a dancer, I work for me as a choreographer. So, you know, I do this solo on this program tonight and the rest of the weekend. When I choreographed it, I used two other dancers in my company, a man and a woman, who were my stunt doubles, basically, and I would make something up, and then they do it and show it to me, and then I change it and learn it, and now when I perform it, the two of them are in charge of maintaining the integrity of the dance. If I start changing it or a mistake starts to become the text of the dance, they tell me, or like, you're too far over there, or you're in the dark, or you're late on that, or, you know, they tell me because I'm doing a dance of my own, but I can't watch it.
But why wouldn't you stand in front of a mirror and say, no, I want my hand turned this way, no, I want it turned that way? Why do you have to put another human body in to move a person around as a sort of stunt double for you?
Because it's very easy, especially years ago, it would have been easier for me. It's very easy for people to dance around and feel fabulous. Like, you put on a record at home, a record. Well, it is a record. You put on a record and dance around and you're fabulous and, like, make yourself cry at the great depth of your feeling. And then if anybody else watched it, you know, it'd be a blank. So in the early days when I couldn't afford a company or a studio or anything, I would make up every part on my own. You know, a big dance. If it had 10 people in it, I would make up every part personally. And then in the very short time I had to work with people, teach them those parts. But feeling great and it being an interesting composition and visually entertaining, frankly, takes more than just I'm such a good dancer, let me just dance around. You know, I think that's...
See, I thought you could maybe get away with that.
I probably can. I mean, there's some dances that have, for me, that are have pockets of sort of improvisation. But really, I learn the text of this dance and I do it. And, you know, there's some variation in it. But, of course, that's because it's live theater and it's me. So I make choices. But really, that's it. Mirrors are bad news. I was rehearsing with Boston Ballet yesterday because they're doing a piece of mine soon. And the first thing I did in class, I taught class. The first thing I did was close the curtains over the mirror because everybody's
you look
in the mirror, and you also watch. You see who's next to you by seeing the distance double in a mirror, and you lose the proprioception. You use the awareness of a warm human near you that you get if you're standing in an elevator too close to somebody you can tell.
Yeah.
If you're in the biggest stage in the world, you can't tell because you've been looking in a mirror. So I think it's a big lie.
So the mirror's out. You want people to look at you as the choreographer and look down at themselves or just feel themselves mm-hmm. as a dancer, not watch themselves in a mirror.
Right. I mean, very often people in a mirror watch themselves. You don't look at your face. You look at what's wrong or right with you. Like, don't I look fabulous, or I'll never be able to do this. But you sort of try to objectify yourself, which I think is a big catastrophe. I want people to, if you're going to use the mirror, look at your face. Do you want people to see that? You know. But anyway, I make up these dances with these two people helping right. me compose it. And then I read it back and I work on it and they give me the notes on it. So I, as a choreographer, I was finished with it a long time ago. You know, the day I finished it, I was done. As a dancer, I still have to follow the rules of that.
We'll talk a little bit more about that when we mm-hmm. come back after the break. My guest is Mark Morris. He is in Boston with his dance group. We'll talk about a little bit more about music, about a fabulous new dance center that the Mark Morris Dance Group calls home when we come back after the break. We'd like to have you join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. The dancer, the choreographer, Mark Morris, is with me in the studio. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And our telephone is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join our conversation. In fact, we'll take our first caller from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Laura's on the line. Laura, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me.
So, what's on your mind?
I wanted to ask Mr. Morris a question. And first of all, tell him I've been a huge swooning fan for about 25 years. I took my 10-year-old son to see Mr. Morris's troupe dance last year because I wanted him to see that dance is not just ballet. He is a very kinetic kid, and I'm trying to interest him in starting some dance lessons. His instinct is to just move to music, just as I've heard Mr. Morris's beginnings in dance were also derived from that instinct. And I wondered if Mr. Morris had any advice about how to get a young boy in a culture that doesn't always encourage boys in dance to take the plunge.
Well, let's see. I think there's way, way less of a stigma than there used to be. Here's what you do. Put on music and chase him around or something. I don't know.
He does that.
Oh, he does that. Okay. I don't know. Just I don't think that it's as strange and scary as it once was. And, you know, I don't know about where you live, about classes and stuff like that. But really, there's always some kind of a fun, creative dancing around movement kind of class, whether he's, you know, if he's ready for some serious, scary discipline. I don't know. But
well, that's the big question is what would you advise a parent and a kid who might have ultimately ambitions in this direction? What's the best training to start with?
Well, I think, you know, I, of course, would push for folk dancing of some sort, where you all go and have a fabulous, fun time, everybody dancing together. You don't have to be very good, and you hold hands, and you can talk while you're dancing, which is always nice. Also, you know, I would suggest studying music in some participatory way, some instrument that's not a synthesizer that would, you know, that helps you figure out how music and the human anatomy are inextricably linked. They're the same thing.
He's a reluctant piano player.
Uh-huh. Fabulous.
Did you start with folk dance, Mark?
I started with Spanish dance more than...
Okay.
I started with Spanish dance, then I added ballet a few years later, and then lots of different kinds of folk dancing.
Like the Balkan ensemble?
Yeah, a lot
ensemble.
Of that. Yeah, a lot of what was called Yugoslav and Bulgarian dancing, a lot of that. And I didn't really study any sort of modern dance till I was a teenager.
Is this in part what draws you to the music of Béla Bartók?
Well,
he was a great collector of folk music, was he not?
Oh, yeah. He was a great ethnomusicologist. Well, he was a musicologist. There probably wasn't that word then. But actually,
well, if you're from Hungary, it's not ethno.
Well, the crazy thing is I bought a couple years ago, because I have a big collection of musics from around, I bought this collection of his cylinders, his own recordings, Bartók's collection.
The old wax cylinders?
Yeah. I mean, it was on CD.
Yeah, of course.
You know, because I don't have a wax cylinder player anymore. But it was like three or five CDs, and I put it on. It just went with like a little, you know, whisper in the back of some flute or something. It was a nightmare. I got rid of it right away. But then, of course, I was these musics that he found and studied of Hungary and the surrounding areas, a lot of Romanian music he was studying, turned into a great deal of his music, especially the chamber music. So.
In fact, one of the pieces that you're premiering in Boston tonight is the String Quartet number 4. Is that right? The whole piece?
Right. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And you have worked with a part of that before. Didn't you choose one of the movements years and years ago?
When I was an adorable child. When I
you
was
were
like,
never an adorable child. If what I read
oh
was
Oh, my God.
True.
I was so adorable.
No, you're a brat.
I was adorable.
Okay.
I was precocious.
You're a revisionist.
I was brilliant. Yeah. I made up a dance when I was probably 16 or 17 for a friend of mine, a solo to the fourth movement of the fourth string quartet, which is all very sort of hushed pizzicato. All of, you know, every of the four instruments plays only pizzicato for it, mostly. And I made up this little dance based a little bit on certain sorts of Balkan dancing, nothing really specific. And it was in my first concert as the Mark Morris Dance Group in 1980 in New York. And I liked it enough that when I started choreographing this piece this last summer, I kept a lot of the material of that dance within the piece as it exists now.
Listening to this, and I'm thinking to myself, this is an enormously challenging piece for a dancer, is it?
It's an enormously challenging piece for a string quartet and a dancer
and a choreographer.
Well, the thing is, you know, it took me quite a while to work on it, and I have a brilliant rehearsal pianist who played a piano reduction of this during rehearsal. He's too young to know that it's impossible. So, you know, I really, and the dancers have to memorize it. That's the thing. The band can read it. And I'm not dismissing that. It's a very, very difficult piece to play. but the dancers have to memorize it as they learn the piece. So we go bar by bar, or I say just, you know, pick out the cello part or the first fiddle part, and the dancers learn that. A lot of the dance is choreographed specifically to the to various string parts. So it took a while, and it's complicated, and also in breaking it down, in studying it and listening to some of the source material, some of the folk music that was the source material, you really find out that it's quite a bit simpler than it seems. It's just incredibly beautifully layered and textured and arranged, but it's pretty factual, the music.
And I watched a little piece of video that the BBC shot of you rehearsing this, and thought to myself that there's a lot of ballet in the way that you lead your dancers through that, just in the partly in the precision, but partly in the way that you have them move. Is that reasonable or not?
Well, all of my dancers have a beautiful knowledge of ballet technique. I mean, that's a lingua franca of dancers, especially at least my dancers. My company class is a ballet class, but I choreograph for ballet companies. My company are great at that, and it's part of the technique as much as they can do very, very difficult rhythms, and they can swap in and out for each other. They're very much more versatile, I can say that frankly, than most classical ballet dancers.
I want to go back to our calls, but there's one little loose thread I want to draw back into the conversation, and that is your reference to folk dance, because to me, folk dance is about dancing either with somebody else or with a group of people. That's almost an essential element to folk dance. But quite often, dance that we imagine in our minds, you're watching independent parts moving on the stage. So how do you look at folk dance? Are you thinking about that as the way one dancer relates to another on stage?
Well, my experience in all the sort of folk dancing I did, and I'm still very much interested. Lately, I'm very much interested in Indian dance, Indian classical dance. I watch a lot of Bharatanatyam dancing and Odissi dancing.
A lot
I don't
of that
do
solo
it,
dancing.
But I love it. That is, yeah, just like flamenco is my first training was in Spanish dance.
Right.
So these sort of dramatic storytelling dances, very often, like a lot of Indian dance is meant to be watched by people, and it's some sort of story or lesson, some sort of instruction very often. Folk dancing, as I use the term, is rarely that. Maybe it has a history, and there's the songs that you sing are important. But really what one does is hold hands with other people and dance together. So, and it's often aimed in a circle or a line that travels. It's not aimed in any particular direction like the audience, the proscenium. So what I've kept from that experience and adore is the fact that music and singing belong together. I mean, music and dancing, singing and dancing belong together. And that I prefer to watch people dance amongst themselves instead of dancing at me. You know, it's like, have you noticed all of the training that I have achieved, you know, and how fabulous I am, and you can't do this.
It's not a gymnastic exercise.
Yeah,
on stage,
it's not a competition, if you ask me, but, you know. So, you know, consequently, my dancers are extremely versatile. They can do rhythms that only the Ballet National du Sénégal can do. And, you know, they're friendly and fun and smart.
Like those things have to be filled in on the application form, right? Are you friendly? Are you fun? Are you smart?
Yes, right. Neatness counts.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Will is joining us. Will, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah.
Mark, I wanted to thank you and credit you for throwing wide open the doors to my appreciation of dance, both modern and classical. And I loved your comment to the first caller about your recommendation of a dancer studying a musical instrument to kind of get that mind-body-music connection. And it made me think about an interview that you gave at Sanders Theater last year when you were here, where you spoke in depth about your choreography being so closely entwined with the music that you're into at the moment. And you mentioned a piece that you had choreographed kind of as an experiment where you choreographed to no music at all, a silent piece. I was wondering, I guess I've been kind of wondering this for the last year, whether you would ever consider kind of reverse engineering that process and either taking that dance or choreographing a new silent dance and then having that dance scored musically. In other words, having the music composed to the dance.
Oh, you mean you're a composer?
I'm not, actually.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm not pitching myself.
No, that's all right. Well, actually, yeah, there's one dance I choreographed that ended up being about 45 minutes long, and that's why I called it Behemoth.
Right.
And it had zero music. The dancing makes a certain amount of sound, of course. But I have to tell you, I've never done the opposite of that. Although when I commissioned a piece of music from the great Mr. Lou Harrison, and I first asked him if he would think of that, he said, well, why don't you choreograph it and send a videotape to me and I'll write the music, which freaked me out completely. And he'd done that before with various choreographers he'd worked with. And I was willing to do it and just make up some stuff and send it and see what he came up with, because he was also a dancer, of course, when amongst other things when he was younger. Okay. And I ended up, he said, oh, never mind, that'll just drive you crazy. Let's just do it the other way. So, you know, really, I don't commission much music because, frankly, it could stink and I have to use it anyway. So I very often prefer, I'm sorry to tell everybody, I prefer to work with dead composers because they're way more cooperative.
And they don't complain as much.
Well, not as much. Not that I can hear. They may roll around a little bit. But
there's Will, thanks for your call. There's another part to that collaboration with Harrison that I find intriguing, and that is that he didn't give you a sort of a full score and say, there you go, Mark, do some dance to that. You got this Lego box of bits that you were allowed to play with or put together. Am I right about that?
Can you say bastard on the radio?
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Okay,
if you
just
had
checking.
To.
All right, that bastard Lou Harrison, when he finally agreed to make up music for me, he said, and this was in his house in Aptos, he said, all right, Mark, I'll write music for you. Never ask me about it again. So I was terrified and went back to New York and just sort of waited around. About 2 weeks later, I got a giant envelope full of music from him. And it included a kit, which was a technique that he had learned from Henry Cowell, who was, you know, he was a teacher of his. And it involves a rhythm sequence, you know, several bars of a rhythm sequence in a particular key that can be, you know, up to maybe the kit he gave me was sort of 12 different systems, 12 staffs of piano music, and another 8 staffs of percussion music, all in the same rhythm, in the same key, and could be used in any sequence at any octave, as many repeats as you want, and in any sequence. So it could be a piece of music that doesn't exist, you never play it, or it could be infinitely long.
But then you're a part of the composing team, because however you choose to put it together, that's what it ends up being, right?
Well, it was a terrible trick, because I'd done several pieces of his music, one that we're doing here in Boston to the grand duo for violin and piano. I dropped a movement of it, of like a 12-minute long sequence of music that's incredibly beautiful, but became, I believe, too sort of inert to make a good dance. The dance is already 25 minutes long, and if I made it 37, it would be too much. So I dropped that. He was kind of angry with me, forgave me, but then got his revenge by just dumping this music into my lap and letting me assemble it.
Was it fun?
It was incredibly fun. And I decided on a sequence, an order of the music, and I choreographed it. The choreography, of course, I made up in segments, too, that could be interchangeable.
Now, but you can do something else, too, that our listeners need to know, and that is that you can look at a piece of music and hear it in your head, right? I mean, you can look at a score, and that's good enough for you to work with. There's something about the mathematical side of your brain that understands symmetry and time and rhythm.
Yeah, I mean, I need to hear a piece. It's better if I hear something first and then can do it, because I'm not that great a score reader, but I can figure it out. An interesting thing about the kit that Lou gave me in this piece that turned out to be called Rhymes with Silver, because that was his middle name, Lou Silver Harrison.
Because nothing rhymes with silver, does
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So that's why they called
point,
it
right?
the dance.
Okay.
And then when it was released, a recording of it was released recently called Rhymes with Silver, and I was very pleased to find out that the sequences of the kits were done according to my plan. You know, I mean, he wrote the music for me and for Yo-Yo and for my pianist and my company. So it's you know, and you couldn't ever hear that piece of music unless you went to the theater.
The music went then back to Lou Harrison, and it became Rhymes with Silver.
That's how the piece is performed, although you could still do it in a kit like you can a lot of Mr. Cowell's music.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest in the studio this hour, Mark Morris, dancer and choreographer. We're going to listen to a little bit of Rhymes with Silver and come back and talk some more after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio this hour, Mark Morris. He is a dancer. He is a choreographer. His company, Mark Morris Dance Group, is performing tonight in Boston. They're based in New York City, where they have a flashy new center. We'll talk about that in just a couple of moments. But we're going to go to Tewksbury, Massachusetts to start. And Michelle's on the line. Michelle, thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a classical pianist. And last summer, I got a job playing at a dance camp in Connecticut in the summer. And one of the things that we would do, and they'd have morning classes, and I would play, and often I would start off with composed music, but then as the teacher would be leading this class, and they'd be talking about, you know, dancing more as a waterfall, or, you know, fairies, or, you know, very fanciful kinds of things, I would start to improvise watching these dancers dance. And these were some of the most incredible musical experiences that I've ever had. Playing and seeing people move in certain ways because of the music I was making.
Who was leading, Michelle? When you're doing that, are you waiting to watch and see a movement and then play to that?
Yes, and there would be a leader, a teacher of the class, and she would be guiding the dancers with words, and so somewhat I would be taking the words and think, oh, what kind of music does this sound like? And then playing, and then watching certain movements as well. Yeah, it was incredible.
Well, that's great, because most people who play piano for dance classes detest it and feel so underappreciated and freaked out, and they usually think it's easy. So I'm glad that it was a wonderful experience for you, waterfalls and fairies and all. Very often people teach, when I teach, it's a very strict format of, you know, 16 multiples of 8 bars, and then it repeats on the other side since you have two halves of your body. And I'm very specific tempo-wise and in sort of the tone of things that should be played. And if one can improvise, that's a fabulous, fabulous bonus. But it can be very frustrating to pianists who are very often good ones to try and keep this stuff going, keep a class going, keep the energy happening at a level which can keep people dancing. It's hard to keep track of, so hooray for you.
If you have the opportunity, Mark, to rehearse with a live musician, is that an important thing for you as a choreographer, for the dancers as well?
I pretty much only do that.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Are you privileged to be a big enough dance hotshot to do that? I mean, I imagine most people don't have that opportunity.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing because, you know, I just did a piece for the San Francisco Ballet that opens in a couple of months. And I, of course, am choreographing this beautiful score of Delib, Sylvia, and I have excellent staff pianists who play rehearsals and class. and the conductor's there most of the time. So it's real music every day in rehearsal. A lot of people would use a recording so you can hear the orchestra or whatever. And I'll do that occasionally so people, you know, you're used to hearing a piano, maybe it's an oboe or whatever. And the pianists are trapped between being thrilled that I notice them and use them and am very specific, and a little upset because then I also notice errors or, you know, speed changes or, you know, things like that, where they're used to being ignored and very often used as sort of background music, and they'll stop rehearsal and not tell the pianist, and people be stopped dancing and talking about something already or on a break, and the pianist is still sweating and pounding. You know, it gets weird. People, guess because people spend so much time with recorded music,
right,
you forget that it's not just one version on your iPod, you know.
1-800-423-8255. Mark Morris is my guest, and next to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Laura's calling. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Laura.
Hi. I got your autograph once in Berkeley, California.
Have you still got it?
Of course.
eBay.
Oh, no.
Oh, sorry.
It's dear to me forever. And I'm jealous of my mother who lives in Berkeley, which is a place you go to much more than Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say, as a former wanting to be professional ballerina and as a former serious student, I wish that I had the Mark Morris inspiration when I was very young, because maybe, I don't know, maybe it would have added something else to my my dance career. But I just want to say you're inspirational to me when I teach.
Uh-huh.
And when I choreograph for my students, I try to remember, just because it feels good doesn't mean it looks good. And also, for all the dancers and dance students out there in Boston, I want to encourage you to go see Mark Morris's company, because they're hugely entertaining, and that's getting a little bit lost in this interview, which is a lot about music, but it's all about entertainment as well.
Well, so's music.
Right.
You know, really, it's all show business in some respect.
Right.
That's wonderful. The Mark Morris inspiration, I'm not sure what that is, but, you know, I, of course, I think I'm smart enough to know if I'm not interested in something. So if I, you know, I love my job. I wish everybody loved his job. And I'm so interested in making up these dances, in working with my wonderful company, in watching things and reading and listening, that keeps me excited and active. And I hope that if I find that just to be a terrible drudgery, that I'm smart enough to stop. But that hasn't happened yet.
Do you ever stop and sort of, when you pull the curtain back, look in the mirror and see someone who runs this great big new dance center in New York City and compares that to the kid who was thought to be a bit of an enfant terrible when he came in the 80s and the 90s, and a lot of people were writing critical stuff about the dance going, who does this person think he is? Have you changed?
Oh, my God. Could you repeat the question? Oh, no. No,
maybe.
That's what I was just telling some cub reporters in the green room of the station. They learned that I wasn't a politician, that I was an artist. And I said, then you can be sure you'll be getting the truth from me. So I think this enfant terrible BS has to do with me being frank and direct and, you know, maybe confrontational. And certainly at that time, the early 80s, I was actively queer. And that's an important, I mean, politically a queer. And that was important to me at the time. Now I couldn't care less. But, you know, I was stirring things up, which is fine, because I now, for example, am in charge of a lot of things. You know, it's time for my generation to be running things.
You're the man.
We are already. Yeah, it's great. So nothing's different, except I now have my own dancing school. Like, I went to, in Seattle, Verla Flowers Dance Arts, and I went there and studied lots of different kinds of dancing. It wasn't a conservatory. I didn't have to wear a uniform. And I had a fabulous time learning about different kinds of dancing and music. And that's what I provided in my school in Brooklyn. We have 300 or 400 students. Most of them are little kids from the neighborhood, from Fort Greene. And it is wonderful.
In the back seat of a taxi and you turn the corner and you see the studio down the street, do you still get a little bit of a thrill, sort of, whoa? Look,
oh, sure. I get a little frisson, and then I also wonder if, you know, like the roof is leaking or something.
That's right. Is the heat working? tell me what you're thinking these days about support for the arts. You got a little bit of help from the city. You got a little bit of help from private institutions. Mm-hmm. You raise your own money at benefit galas, that sort of thing. Are you looking at a healthy dance community in America now? Or do you see people around you who are not able to survive because people are too dismissive of it? What are you seeing?
Oh, brother. I don't see much, frankly. You know, I sure wish that the arts were seen as the necessity, the requirement for civilization that they actually are, instead of as some kind of, you know, elitist bauble, you know, that's, you know, disposable. It's ridiculous and insulting. So, of course, there's nearly zero government money. And after having said what I just did, there's probably going to be zero. But, you know, there's almost zero arts education in public schools. And, you know, that's a shame. That and universal health insurance. And then, you know, everything would be fine. I don't go to a lot of dance shows. I very often don't like them. And since I'm not a dance critic.
What do you mean a dance show?
Dance performance.
Okay, sorry.
I'm very often disappointed. I don't like it very much in some way. And since I'm not a dance critic, I'm not required to go. So instead of leaving at intermission, I kind of don't go. I see some things I like, and God knows there's no shortage of wonderful dancers. There just isn't a lot of work, and I think people who would have gone into something like dancing or choreography are less likely to, because you can sort of get your creative rocks off in other ways that you make more money from or something. I don't know.
I wonder sometimes, though, whether or not the dance community itself, if there is such a thing, doesn't also kind of favor its elite status and keep people at arm's length for doing that.
Hooray.
You know, it's kind of like our club, right?
It's kind of like, you know, if you have to ask how much it costs, you can't afford it. It's a little like that. It's like, you'll never understand my work, so why bother? Or, you know, I'm stereotyping here, but, you know, why not? There's always reason to do that. You know, there's the my work can only be understood by other people who do this. That was a problem with a lot of academic modern music, contemporary music, sort of around, you know, the end of World War II. Everybody ended up writing music for each other. That's the same with poetry. And, of course, I'm generalizing. There was also lots of great stuff. But that's true with dancing. There's, you know, there's a self-perpetuating, you know, university system of dance that I think is mostly just to feed itself. It's auto-cannibalistic and doesn't really reflect the needs or desires of dance in the culture at large.
So how do you kick the door open? How do you open the club up?
Well, one thing is, although it's difficult, complicated, expensive, and time-consuming, we work only with live music. So people who like music come to my shows instead of, you know, the dance fan brings her husband who's a music fan, and the first thing you hear the tape recorder click on, I'm dating myself here, and you hear the same Arvo Pärt recording that you have at home. It's like, well, I could have made that up myself. But if you come in and hear a piece of music that you've never heard before, or one played in a way that you haven't heard, you're piqued in another way, and you may like that sort of synthesis, music and dance together, which is, I think, how they should go.
I was going through a little bit of a checklist earlier about where you're going to be over the next month or so.
And, let me know.
Yeah, you know, just the little black book on the April page has you at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, Champaign-Urbana after that, performances in San Diego, while the Sylvia piece is ready to be presented in San Francisco, mm-hmm. with the ballet there. And I think you have a new dance which is coming up early June.
Right.
Am I missing anything here?
Yeah, right after the opening night of Sylvia in San Francisco, I have to fly to Dublin for some shows. So, yeah, and that's what we do. So, you know, we're on the road 6 months, pretty much. And when not, we're rehearsing in New York. I'm making up a new dance. And we usually don't go out for more than a couple weeks at a time, which is wonderful because we're all adults. And, you know, it's not like a fun vacation anymore to just get on an airplane for...
You don't like airports?
For 18 hours. Oh, I don't know. I'm attached. But yeah, there's a new dance coming up that I've been working on since January. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to turn out yet. But that's, you know, that's what keeps me interested and, I think, alive. I'm not sure.
We're going to listen to a little piece of music to end the program. And this is also from the, I think it's from Rhymes with Silver. Is that right? The foxtrot that we decided to play?
Yeah, from Mr. Lou Harrison, yeah.
A friend of yours and someone who you'll be dancing to tonight. And, I mean, a piece that that you're fond of, rather attached to.
Absolutely.
Well, then why don't I shut up and we can listen to that music. And before I do that, though, I'll say thank you very much for coming in. It's nice to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much.
Mark Morris, dancer and choreographer. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.